Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Biden to discuss political crisis with Ukraine's leaders, and Eritrean American wins Boston Marathon. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has arrived in Kiev for talks with Ukraine's acting president and prime minister. His visit comes as the situation in eastern Ukraine remains tense, despite a deal aimed at easing the crisis. White House officials say Biden will discuss the international community's efforts to help Ukraine move forward on constitutional reform and what Obama administration officials say will be a free and fair presidential election on May 25th. Biden meets Tuesday with the acting leaders of Ukraine's government, Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk and President Oleksandr Turchynov. The United States has also threatened further sanctions on Russia if Moscow continues its support of pro-Russian demonstrators in eastern Ukraine. Eritrean American Meb Kefesgi has become the first American in decades to win the Boston Marathon in the first running of the annual event since last year's deadly bombing that killed three and injured hundreds. Pumping his fist in exhilaration, Kefesgi crossed the finish line with a time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 37 seconds. No American runner has won since 1985, and an American man has not won since 1983. Scott Kennedy, who did not run Boston last year, was one of many who talked yesterday, Sunday, about what Monday's race means to everyone taking part.
Just to show the terrorists that they can't win, I saw a picture a few weeks ago that said we need to take our finish line back, and that's what I think 36,000 people are going to do tomorrow, is take the finish line back.
And took it back, they did. The United Nations has accused rebels in South Sudan of killing hundreds of people in a small town based on their nationality or ethnic origin. The slayings took place in Bentiu after rebel forces seized the town from government troops on April 15th. The mission says the rebels killed more than 200 and wounded more than 400 civilians at a local mosque, where hundreds of people had taken shelter to escape fighting. The UN mission says the rebels, known as the SPLA in opposition, also killed several people at a Catholic church and a vacated World Food Program compound after asking them to identify their ethnicity. Candidates can begin registering Tuesday for Syria's presidential election, which the country's parliament speaker says will take place June 3rd. The vote announced Monday will give President Bashar al-Assad the chance to win a third 7-year term in office. Mr. Assad has been battling rebels in a conflict that began as peaceful protests in March 2011 and quickly grew into a civil war that has killed more than 150,000 people. South Korea's president says the actions of the captain and the crew of the ferry that capsized last week with 476 aboard were like murder. Park Geun-hye said Monday their behavior was incomprehensible and unacceptable. The captain, the third mate, and one other crew member were arrested Saturday on charges of deserting their passengers as the ferry was sinking. Divers have pulled more than 60 bodies from the sunken boat. More than 200 people are still unaccounted for. Most of the victims were high school students. Officials say a 16-year-old boy from the western U.S. state of California is lucky to be alive after hiding in an airplane wheel well on a 5-hour flight to the Pacific Island state of Hawaii. A Federal Bureau of Investigation spokesman said the boy ran away from home Sunday morning, climbed a fence at the airport in San Jose, California, before stowing away in the Hawaiian Airlines flight. Marvin Moniz, an airport official in Maui, said personnel there spotted the boy on the tarmac.
He wasn't too cooperative or too communicative at that time, and security was called, and upon arrival, security questions was asked to this juvenile, and he wasn't too cooperative. We did have security bring him in, and he was questioned by TSA and also the FBI.
A spokesman for Hawaiian Airlines said the boy is exceptionally lucky to have survived. And the famed Sherpa guides of Nepal are considering a strike following a massive avalanche at Mount Everest last week that killed 13 guides. The Sherpas are seeking better pay and welfare provisions. That's the news from The Voice of America. I'm Bob Doty reporting.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight. From the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan says rebels killed hundreds of civilians in ethnically motivated attacks when they captured the town of Bentiu last week.
That's Margaret Bashir reporting. Details on this topic next. Also in the news, Boko Haram takes responsibility for last week's bombing in Abuja. And a member of Somalia's parliament has been killed by a car bomb in Mogadishu. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Nigerian militant sect Boko Haram says it carried out the deadly bombing in the capital Abuja last week that killed at least 71 people. VOA's Anlook reports from our West Africa Bureau that confidence in the government and the military to deal with Boko Haram is reaching a new low in Nigeria.
In his new video, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau waved a stick and addressed Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. "You are just too small," he says. "You are just too small for us." Shekau taunted Nigerian authorities who have repeatedly pledged to put down the now five-year-old insurgency in a matter of months. The Nyanya bus station bombing was Boko Haram's first major attack in the capital in 2 years, something analysts say show its capabilities remain intact, despite the almost year-long military offensive against the rebels. Most of Boko Haram's attacks take place in the far northeast. Analysts also say the size and sophistication of the blast suggests the militants have strengthened their connections abroad. Visiting the bomb site last week, President Jonathan tried to downplay the seriousness of the threat. "The Boko Haram problem is, quote, temporary," he said. But Nigerians in the most violence-prone areas of the north tell VOA they aren't reassured.
"Honestly, my brother, we are not saving this country. If Abuja could experience that, any other part of the state is just a child's play to them."
Three northeastern states have been under a state of emergency for almost a year, but the violence has intensified.
"Well, Nigeria is afraid. Nigeria is scared. The security said they are in control. But from the look of things, I doubt if they are."
Amnesty International says 1,500 people have been killed this year in the conflict between Boko Haram insurgents and the Nigerian security forces, more than half of them civilians. Analysts say the military's heavy-handed tactics since the insurgency began in 2009 have alienated the population. Some people living in the northeast say soldiers are overwhelmed and outgunned. Others say that security forces are just dysfunctional.
"Truly, I have a confidence over them, but there are factors that has to be addressed. Yes, the cooperation in between the forces. There are a lot of lapses."
The military's credibility took a hit last week when Defense Headquarters had to retract its claim that all but eight of the more than 100 schoolgirls kidnapped in Borno State had been freed. Most of the girls are still missing after armed men raided their school last Tuesday. At least 32 girls have escaped on their own. The defense spokesman said the false claim was an honest mistake, but that hasn't stopped the criticism.
"The disbar, at the end of the day, we discovered that it was all lie. So tell me, how do we trust our security agents?"
A local newspaper columnist called the communications debacle, along with the ease with which the girls appear to have been abducted, a, quote, smoking gun, and proof that authorities are not being honest about the situation in the northeast. The government and security forces say they are doing what they can, but with each new attack, frustration mounts. Anne Luck, VOA News, Dakar.
A member of Somalia's parliament has been killed by a car bomb in Mogadishu. Isaac Mohamed Ibrahim was killed when a bomb concealed in his vehicle exploded in the capital, Hamerwin district. Another lawmaker, Mahmoud Abdi, was wounded in the attack. The attack and casualties were confirmed by the Somali Prime Minister's office. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. The Al-Qaeda-linked group has lost much of its territory over the past few years to African Union and Somali government troops. but the militants continue to carry out periodic attacks. In February, 17 people were killed when Al-Shabaab fighters stormed the presidential palace, and at that time, President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed was not harmed in the assault. The United Nations mission in South Sudan says rebels killed hundreds of civilians in ethnically motivated attacks when they captured the town of Bentiu last week. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
The UN strongly condemned what it called targeted killings of civilians which took place along national and ethnic lines. In a statement, the UN mission, known as UNMISS, said more than 200 civilians were reportedly killed and over 400 wounded in the Bentiu Mosque, where they had gone to flee the violence. It said fighters with the rebel force known as the SPLA in opposition separated individuals based on their ethnicities and nationalities, safely escorting some out of the mosque and killing others. Similar attacks were reported at a Catholic church, an evacuated World Food Program compound, and Bentiu Hospital. Sudanese of Darfuri ethnicity were also targeted. The UN also condemned the use of the local radio station by rebels to incite killings and rape. UN peacekeeping spokesman Nick Birnbach told VOA that UNMISS has deployed additional peacekeepers from its 8,000-plus strong force to Bentiu and other locations where attacks have been reported.
But the truth of the matter is that we can't be everywhere at all times. Also, our peacekeepers are focusing on the protection of civilian sites where we are sheltering thousands and thousands of terrified IDPs who are fleeing the violence and who are depending on us for their security.
Last week, peacekeepers helped get hundreds of civilians in threatened areas in Bentiu and Robkona to their base for protection. The base is now refuge for more than 22,000 people. The UN's Birnbach said there is a vicious cycle of attack and counterattack happening.
Civilians are, as always, bearing the brunt of it. We're doing everything we can to work with local authorities to try to not only investigate but deter. But ultimately, it is the authorities in South Sudan who are going to have to take action to stop these terrible events from continuing to occur.
Fighting erupted in South Sudan in December as the army of President Salva Kiir and rebels allied with his former vice president Riek Machar began fighting each other. Violence has now displaced more than 1 million South Sudanese from their homes. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Rebels loyal to former South Sudanese Vice President Riek Machar say they have captured another town in Unity State. Rebel spokesman James Gadet Dak says his forces are in control of Mayum. He says the town has been the main supply center for South Sudan Army in Unity State. He spoke to reporter John Tanza.
They were moving towards the direction of Bentiu, and our forces intercepted them and engaged them. After defeating them, they pursued them into Mayum, and this resulted in the capture of Mayum. This is a very strategic town. It is at the border with Warabi State. This is a place where government forces used to reinforce and resupply when they want to launch further attacks into other parts of Unity State from Bargaza region.
And now, you're saying your forces are in control of Mayum town. What is next after Mayum?
We will always try to disrupt their strongholds, which they use to launch further attacks. From Mayum, we will see where they regroup, and if we learn that they plan to launch a counterattack against us, we will prevent.
This looks like your forces have disregarded the cessation of hostility agreement that you signed with the government of South Sudan in Addis Ababa?
No, it was the government that violated the cessation of hostilities agreement in the first day of Infeature. You remember in Jonglei State, on the 23rd of January, when the cessation of hostilities agreement was signed, it was the government of Salva Kiir that violated it on the very day. So we have been defending ourselves. We are not violating the cessation of hostilities agreement, but we are defending ourselves because We will not allow them to come to us and attack us when there is this agreement.
In defending yourself, you are fighting, and the agreement says you should stop fighting.
Yes, but why is the other side keeping attacking us? So this is a question you should throw to them.
That's James Cadet Dak, spokesman for Rebels allied to former South Sudan vice president turned rebel leader Riek Machar. The UN mission in South Sudan confirms there is fighting around Mayum town, but did say the town is in control of the rebels. The group Human Rights Watch is calling on the international community to take action over the killings of civilian protesters in Sudan last September. The protesters took to the streets to complain about expensive living conditions. In a report released today, the group is criticizing the Khartoum government, saying it has failed to investigate serious abuses committed by police and security forces. Nabil Biajo has more on the story.
Jane Henry is a senior researcher with the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch. She says the international community has done little to hold the government in Sudan accountable for killing civilian protesters more than 6 months ago.
The international community has been quite silent about the issue of these killings in September. In fact, as many as 170 people were killed during these protests, and there is evidence implicating government forces in these killings. This is a very large number of civilians who were killed by a government, and the follow-up has been next to nothing.
Henry says the government of Sudan routinely violates human rights.
We have many, many reports of ongoing violations of international humanitarian law. So these conflicts are all a part of a larger context of pervasive human rights abuses and political repression in Sudan.
She says even though President Omar al-Bashir is calling for more freedoms in Sudan in a dialogue with the opposition, forces loyal to him are still murdering civilians.
Our point is to really emphasize and to remind to the world that during this period of transition, Sudan has blood on its hands.
Khartoum says it is investigating alleged crimes that took place during the protest last September. Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says it will take time to bring the perpetrators to book.
This sort of investigations cannot be done within 1 or 2 days. It is a meticulous thing. And there is a shooting fire from here and you cannot do this.
Bilal says the government has released all those who were arrested in connection with the protest. He said the detainees who are still in prison have been convicted of criminal acts and insist that their detention is not politically motivated.
They are all released. We have no detainee in prisons now, no political detainee now. But there are some people who did the looting. And they stole some of possessions from houses and they made damages.
Sudanese human rights lawyer Abdul Munaim disputes that claim. Munaim, who is a member of the Grifna Youth Activist Group, which opposes President Bashir's government, says he works with many families who are still begging the government to release their loved ones.
There are many people now in detention and in contact with many families. Until now, they asking to release the member of these families.
Abdul Munaim says he was just released from prison himself. He was arrested when he presented in court the family of a student who was shot dead by Sudanese security forces during a protest in March. He says he was held in a cold room with very bright lights. Abdul Munaim says he has been jailed by the authorities numerous times. He says each time he has been exposed to extreme cold and bright lights. He says it has negatively impacted his health. Grifna takes its name from the Arabic word that means we are fed up. Its members advocate for regime change in Sudan and seek to expose human rights abuses by President Bashir's government. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaju in Washington.
Listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Confidence in the government and the military to deal with Boko Haram is reaching a new low in Nigeria. A member of Somalia's parliament has been killed by a car bomb in Mogadishu, and the UN mission in South Sudan has accused rebels of killing hundreds of civilians based on ethnicity. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. A new report says organized crime, government corruption, and militias are all linked to elephant poaching and the illegal ivory trade. It says poachers in Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Sudan, and Kenya move across borders with near impunity. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The report is called Ivory's Curse, the militarization and professionalization of poaching in Africa. It's a joint effort by the conservation group Born Free USA and C4ADS, a nonprofit organization that analyzes the drivers of conflict and insecurity. Adam Roberts is Born Free USA Chief Executive Officer.
For years, Born Free USA and other animal advocates have campaigned against the trade in elephant ivory, but on conservation and animal welfare concerns. And we wanted to find a little bit more detail about who was behind the ivory trade. It's not just enough to say it's criminal syndicates, nefarious profiteers. We wanted to know who was really behind it so that we can try and get governments around the world to do more to crack down.
Robert says Born Free needed some help in gathering that kind of information.
That's one of the reasons that we commissioned C4ADS to do the report for us, because I think the breadth of our capabilities within the conservation community are pretty much limited to conservation, but having a defense analyst that looks at the militarism behind all of these poaching incidents gives them access to information that we wouldn't otherwise have.
The report provides regional case studies of the ivory trade. For example, in Sudan, the report says government-allied militias complicit in the Darfur genocide fund their operations by poaching elephants. But it goes on to say that poaching occurs hundreds of miles outside of Sudan's borders. In Somalia, the report blames the militant group Al-Shabaab and criminal networks who poach in neighboring Kenya. The weapons they use, it says, come from local security forces.
It's not going to come as a shock to anyone that Somalia is implicated in the ivory trade. And again, much like Sudan, you have these actors that are able to move cross borders from Somalia to different countries in the region. But probably the biggest part of that, though, is the inability of some of those surrounding countries, those neighboring countries, to deter the ivory trade from the people in either Sudan or Somalia because they lack the resources to do so.
The report says organized crime in Mozambique is willing to battle the South African Army and park rangers to poach rhino horn. In Gabon and the Republic of Congo, it says forest exploitation has allowed East Asian organized crime to come to the region and poach Central Africa's elephants. And Robert says Zimbabwe continues to be a poaching hotspot.
Partly what's happening with poaching in Zimbabwe is a result of the political situation where you have a regime that's been in place for so long that we feel is complicit in the ivory trade because of giving impunity to the actors involved in the ivory trade in the country, that it's very hard to get a handle on what's happening. You know, in 1997, when the international ban on trade in elephant ivory was first undermined, one of the countries that was behind that was Zimbabwe, and the meeting, the international meeting where that happened, was held in Harare.
The Born Free CEO says combating poaching requires a coordinated strategy all along the ivory trade chain.
So it's not enough to talk about demand reduction in Asia, which could take years and years to accomplish. And it's not just about putting boots on the ground, so to speak, and equipping rangers. You have to look at all of the different choke points where you can make an impact, including the shipping routes. And so the more we can do to try and close down the ability of these nefarious individuals to move the ivory from elephants that have been slaughtered, the more success we'll have in keeping it off the market in the first place.
Robert says that coordinated strategy against elephant poaching must once again include an unequivocal international ban on ivory. In 1989, members of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, agreed to ban international trade in ivory.
Since 1997, you've had a continual weakening of that ban, and the more that that happens, the more individuals realize that there's a market either now or in the near future for ivory.
Robert says there must also be a crackdown on domestic markets. What's more, he says, problem countries should be readily identified, accompanied by targeted recommendations.
The recommendations that might occur in, say, Tanzania or Zimbabwe, which are related to corruption, are not going to be the same recommendations that you would want in a place like Kenya, where you need to really bolster the infrastructure to ward off the poachers.
The report, Ivory's Curse, says the ivory trade is essentially a large-scale illicit resource transfer from Africa to Asia.
You're looking at thousands of dollars per kilo of ivory these days, which is sort of back to the pre-1989 international ban levels. The price of ivory has been rising considerably. It's definitely becoming a conflict resource, much like coltan or diamonds in Africa. But when you're looking at that kind of money, you're ultimately ending up in a trade that's worth perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars each year.
Roberts calls the report a first step. He says he hopes it will encourage defense and foreign affairs officials to get involved. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The chief warden of DRC's Virunga National Park says he hopes to recover soon and is looking forward to getting back to work with a renewed vigor. Emmanuel Demerode was shot in the chest last week by three gunmen while driving from Goma to his home at park headquarters in Rumangoba. It's still unclear who attacked him or why. He says, however, such attacks against park rangers are not uncommon as they attempt to restore peace and the rule of law in the area. Demerode thanked all those who assisted him after he was wounded, including the surgeons at the Hill Africa Hospital. Registrations for Egypt's presidential candidates closed with only two candidates meeting the 2 p.m. Sunday deadline. Leftist activist Hamdine Sabi became the sole challenger for ex-military leader Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in the May 26-27 election. Sabi was an early supporter of the Tahrir Square demonstrations that drove Mubarak from office in 2011. He later placed third in the 2012 presidential race that resulted in the election of Mohamed Morsi. A longtime opposition politician, Sabi was arrested and jailed more than a dozen times under President Anwar Sadat and Hosni Mubarak. The Electoral Commission will review the candidates' petitions and announce the official ballot on May 2nd. Sisi is currently favored to win. As Egypt's former military chief and Morsi's defense minister, Sisi ousted Morsi less than a year ago during a popular demonstration against Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood backers. The Brotherhood has been declared a terrorist organization. Morsi and many of his supporters are now on trial for treason and inciting riots. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa
to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Confidence in the government and the military to deal with Boko Haram is reaching a new low in Nigeria. A member of Somalia's parliament has been killed by a car bomb in Mogadishu, and the UN mission in South Sudan has accused rebels of killing hundreds of civilians based on ethnicity. Coming up, music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, trying to stop the dumping of electronic waste in Central Africa. I'm Ihe Iswuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
How was your vacation, Sunny?
I had a nice break. It was a good break.
I understand it's a big sports day in Boston.
Big sports day indeed, Yehias. The 118th running of the Boston Marathon on Monday. And Kenya once again celebrated another marathon victory. Rita Jeptu successfully defended her women's title in Boston, and Rita did it in thrilling fashion. She set a new course record of 2 hours, 18 minutes, and 57 seconds. On the men's side in Boston, Yehias, Meb Kiflezgi, who was born in Eritrea, but he's been running for the United States throughout his athletic career, had a great race. He ran from the front of the pack, broke away at about the halfway point, and he crossed the finish line first in 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 38 seconds. Kenya's Wilson Chebet was second on the men's side. He finished 10 seconds back in 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 48 seconds. And another Kenyan, Franklin Chepkwony of Kenya. He finished in 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 50 seconds. And, Yehias, I know Ethiopia has traditionally done very well in marathon running. And sure enough, they finished second and third on the women's side. Buzanesh Deba clocked 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 59 seconds. And Mare Dibaba of Ethiopia had a winning time of 2 hours, 20 minutes, and 35 seconds. Now, Mare Dibaba, she had the fastest marathon time in the field, 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 52 seconds. But this day belonged to Rita Jeptu. Her winning time, 2 hours, 18 minutes, and 57 seconds. Lots of emotions surrounding this race. After last year's tragic circumstances in Boston, in which 2 bomb blasts at the finish line near Boylston Street killed 3 people and wounded more than 260 others. In the wake of this bombing, Boston adopted a simple slogan called Boston Strong. And on Monday, you could see that Boston Strong banner along the side of the course. And, yeah, hey, it's looked like record crowds in Boston for this marathon.
I was stunned. 36,000
runners? 36,000
runners.
In fact, it I believe, second largest field in the history of this race. The only other time there were more runners was the 100th running of the Boston Marathon, the centennial in 1996. In which there were over 38,700 runners. And we were watching the race before we came into the studio.
Yes.
Looked like a beautiful day for running, Yehias.
How many do you estimate in Boston? People on the sidelines?
Well, typically they get about 500,000 spectators watching the race, but This year, I think there were well over a million spectators, and many were cheering for Meb Keflezighi, the men's winner, who I think Eritrea should, they should cheer for him. I mean, he was born in Eritrea. But as I said, he came to this country, I think, when he was just a teenager.
Exactly. He won the London. Was he not the
New York City Marathon champion?
Yes.
And if we go back 10 years, Yehias, he was the silver medalist at the 2004 Olympics in Athens. So he's got a really nice running pedigree. Meb Keflezighi.
What is up with that Horn of Africa area? I mean, Eritrea, Kenya, Ethiopia?
they really dominate when it comes to marathon running, Yehias. We're hoping to get Parker Morse on the line. Parker is a senior writer for Running Times magazine, and he's in Boston for the race. We have had some technical difficulties. But, getting back to the race itself, I know there was a lot of concern, Yehias, about security, and I think this year the runners had to go through some special security concerns. But joining us now from Boston is Parker Morse, senior writer for Running Times magazine. Hello, Parker.
Hi, Sonny.
Talk to us about first the women's race, Parker. Rita Jeptu, new course record.
That was an absolutely phenomenal race. Shalane Flanagan was of the USA was running with a lot of emotion from the beginning. She set a blistering pace down out of Hopkinton. They were ahead of course record pace the entire way. And then Jeptu really, she stuck with that lead from the beginning. And when they got into the hills and everybody else started to get weak, she really put the hammer down. And for somebody to win the Boston Marathon three times in their career, to set a course record doing it, to set a PR. And bear in mind that the first time Rita Jeptu won the Boston Marathon was 2006. So she's got an incredible career booked up now.
Let's go to the men's race, Parker. Meb Keflezighi, heroic performance. It looked like he ran front of the pack for a good portion of the race.
He did. Meb was in the lead either in the lead or in sight of the lead for almost the entire race. And again, somebody who, as soon as they reached the hills, Meb really kind of broke the race open coming out of Newton Lower Falls, which is the really the end of the downhills in Boston and the beginning of a series of climbs up into the last hill, Heartbreak. He really broke it open there, and the big surprise, I think, was that more of the athletes in the pack didn't take that move seriously and didn't move to close the gap until it was really too late.
At the later stages, Parker, did you think that Chebet, the Kenyan, was going to catch Meb? I mean, it looked like he was faltering a bit, but then he sort of regained strength.
It's entirely reasonable to say that that race was in question right up until till the very end. Chebet was as close to Meb as 6 seconds, and that he was closing the gap in the last mile, and it was only in the very last mile of the course. For those who aren't familiar with the course has a short hill down and an up again under Massachusetts Avenue, and then there's the only turns on the course. You make a right on Hereford and a left on Boylston. And it was really when they went under Mass Ave and started that right and left sequence that Meb really, really had it in hand. Chebet tried really hard to close the gap and just couldn't get any closer than 6 seconds.
If we look at the history books, Parker, is Meb one of the older runners to win the Boston Marathon?
At 39, I think there are. I don't think that there are many. Boston winners. Even as old, I think it might be probably to find an older Boston winner, we would have to go back to Clarence DeMar.
Meb, born in Eritrea, but he's been running for the United States for a long time. Looked like he had a lot of support out on the course, Parker.
Not just on the course. Apparently, when the results went up on the scoreboard in Fenway Park at the Red Sox baseball game, it was quite a roar.
Parker, as you know, a lot of emotions surrounding this 118th Boston Marathon after last year's tragic bomb blasts on Boylston Street. What was your sense about the mood today?
You know, there was the real feeling of moving on. Because the marathon comes later in the calendar this year, the 1 year memorial was much earlier. It was actually last Tuesday, and so the feeling today was very much, we've remembered, and now we're going to start writing the rest of the history. We're going to move on. We're going to write some good stuff down. And there's a real strong feeling, even among the organizers, there's this feeling of, we know how to do this, and we're going to do it, and we're going to show people how it works when things are going well.
What's your take on the crowds on Monday, Parker? Record crowds in Boston?
There is no question in my mind. There were more people on the course than I've ever seen. I live in Natick, which is around the 10-mile mark, and watching the race go through Natick, there were more people than I've seen on the streets of Natick ever.
A lot of celebrities, I think, came back for this year's Boston. Any updates on that end, Parker?
Well, that depends on what you want to call a celebrity. as far as running celebrities go, we had Joan Benoit Samuelson, who's a two-time winner here and the Olympic gold medalist in 1984. Former men's champions Jalindo Bordin from 1990 and Ambie Burfoot from 1968 are both running. They're still on the course. And then Uta Pippig, who is a three-time winner and the last, not the last, but a three-time winner in the 1990s, actually meant to run the 5K on Saturday, arrived too late and then entered the marathon yesterday.
Mm.
So the first entrant to this year's Boston Marathon was Shalane Flanagan, who wound up finishing seventh, and the last was Uta Pippig.
Parker, can you give our Voice of America listeners the breakdown on prize money for the top runners?
The first prize is going to be tough to say because there are prize money bonuses that are going to get paid out, particularly for Jeptu, because Jeptu absolutely demolished the course record. The course record, which was Margaret Okayo's from 10 years ago, Jeptu took nearly 2 minutes off that. So they'll be adding up time bonuses in both races.
The 118th Boston Marathon, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Parker Morse, senior writer for Running Times magazine. The men's winner, Meb Keflezighi, first American, I think, Parker, since 1993 to win the Boston Marathon?
The first American male since 1983.
83.
First American
83.
At all since 1985.
Mm-mm. Now, after he crossed the finish line, it looked like a former champion kind of congratulated him, Parker.
I didn't spot that. What did you see?
Was it Greg?
Yes.
I thought
Greg Meyer, the last American man to win Boston in 1983. Greg has been going to the finish line for several years now because he has been very vocal about saying that he does not want to spend any more time being trotted out as the last American to win Boston, and now he's finally put that to bed.
Rita Jeptu, as you mentioned, Parker, three-time champion now on the women's side at the Boston Marathon. Where do you think she ranks now in terms of the great female runners at Boston?
Well, now she's the fastest ever, and I think that the span of time she sits up with Pippig, with Roba, and with Okayo as one of the best. Certainly one of the top five, if not one of the best ever.
And Parker, I want to take nothing away from Meb Keflezighi and his winning time of 2:08:38. And yet there was some talk that we were going to see a much faster time in Boston, especially from some of the Kenyans. Did you think it would be a faster race?
Fast times in Boston are always dependent on the weather, and we're really waiting to the last minute to see what the wind is going to look like. And it turned out that they really had very favorable weather. It might have been a little bit warm, but the other part of it was that there was very aggressive running, particularly in the women's race, which was something of a surprise. I was expecting the women to be much more conservative.
Finally, Parker, in the disabled category, can you give us the men's and women's wheelchair winners?
Yes, Ernst van Dijk was the men's wheelchair winner. He's a South African. He's won here many times before, but most recently in 2010. So this is something of a comeback for him. And then on the women's side, the winner was Tatiana McFadden. She's a 25-year-old American from Illinois. And McFadden was actually our first charity runner. She was taking pledges and raising money for the memory of Martin Richard, who was one of the victims of the bomb attacks last year.
Parker Moore, senior writer for Running Times magazine. And if our VOA listeners can tune in our Africa 54 TV program, Parker will be joining us there very shortly on Africa 54. Parker, thank you for chatting with us from Boston.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you, Parker. And we're going to send it back to Yahias Wuhib. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports.
All the participants in the Boston Marathon are winners, Sonny, and thank you. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Interpol has assembled civil society groups and police chiefs from Central African countries to map out ways to stop the dumping of electronic waste in the nations which do not have the means to safely dispose of toxic electronic products. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's Environment Ministry official in charge of toxic and hazardous waste, Lemnyoi William, says it is time African countries stop importing unwanted electronics.
We will not continue to be a dump site for many electronic equipment that have gone out of use in many developed countries.
The International Police Agency's Regional Office for Central Africa in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, estimates 70% of computers and mobile phones sold in Africa were first used in developed countries. And the main reason, according to experts, is that the United States and Europe have stringent environmental laws on proper disposal of used electronic gadgets, and so it is cheaper to export them to Africa than to dispose of them at home. In response, Interpol organized a meeting of regional police chiefs and civil society groups here in Yaoundé to figure out ways to deal with electronic waste dumping, which poses an environmental hazard in a region with the least ability to deal effectively with it. E-waste management expert Leke Kasmir explains how electronic dumping is dangerous.
A computer is made up of about 1,000 elements. Those 1,000 elements are all toxic. When it becomes obsolete, it is dumped. And when it is dumped, these substances are washed off by rainwater. It filters into the water system, and people carry the water and drink, and it affects them. Or women use that water from swampy areas to water vegetables that you and me go to the market and buy. It eats us up without us knowing.
Lemnyoi adds that such electronics have health consequences for animals and humans.
E-waste has heavy metals, and when these heavy metals are released because they have been burned in the environment or being washed out during their disposal, they pollute the environment. And when it is burned, the toxic chemicals that are released cause various cancer problems into various people.
In 2013, African officials met in Bamako and adopted an international convention on hazardous waste, which called for uniform action to end the import of discarded electronic goods. But Leke says implementation will take time, and so law enforcement and civil society groups are first stressing the need to increase public awareness.
It is very difficult for you to stop those countries. So let us first of all start off by educating, sensitizing creating some sort of awareness of the danger of electronic waste. If they are not sensitized, they will think that it is business.
Interpol's Central African Regional Officer for Electronic Material, Conrad Atefo, tells VOA involving police in combating e-waste is another key tool.
The police have a role of protecting the environment. Crimes are committed against the environment, like pollution in all its forms, and the police are there to enforce laws and also to bring to justice defaulters. The police will be able to assist in carrying out investigations and helping in tracking down those who import equipment that are forbidden.
The United Nations Environment Programme reported that in 2012, about 220,000 tons of electronic goods were shipped from the European Union to West Africa. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
French filmmaker Luc Jacquet won worldwide acclaim for his 2005 Academy Award-winning documentary, March of the Penguins. Now Jacquet is back with a new film that takes moviegoers deep into the heart of a tropical rainforest, not only to celebrate its grandeur, but to make the case for its survival. Roseanne Skirbel reports.
Once Upon a Forest is a visual poem that conveys the wonder of the rainforest, says Luc Jacquet. He spent 5 months with his crew filming in majestic forests in Gabon and Peru.
Just to say once again how this forest is amazing, how they are fascinating, how they are in balance.
Jacquet teams with famed French botanist Francis Hallet to tell the story of the forest, which opens with the 75-year-old Hallet calmly drawing on his sketch pad. He's perched 70 meters up in the parasol-like crown of a Moabi tree in Gabon's Congo River Basin. Jacquet says his work on the film helped him understand for the first time what Hallet has been preaching for decades, that trees have their own way to be alive.
When you go in this kind of thinking, you discover a new universe, the universe of trees. And it's interesting because at that point, you begin to start to think that this is not the animals who are the kings of the forest. The trees are the king of the forest.
The movie captures the life story of the rainforest. Within that tale are dozens of actors, a parade of leaf-cutting ants, a fruit-eating, sea-dropping monkey, a jaguar that prowls across the screen with stealthy steps, and vines that entangle a mighty strangler fig tree to make way for another giant to take its place in the forest. Some of those events can take hundreds of years in tree time, so Jacquet speeds them up by animating Hallet's drawings and mixing them with close-up live action.
To be clear, between what I'm able to see and what I imagine.
Inside all this imagery is a world where every plant and every animal is intimately connected with one another. Trees keep this ever-growing, ever-changing family in balance.
Yeah, this is very amazing. But, you know, we start to understand the language of the trees and the language of the flowers. And we know that trees are not talking with words, they are talking with scents. And they are able to mix this sense, like words to make a text. And they are able to exchange message. They are able to modify the behavior of animals with this substance.
He says the chemicals can even affect the weather. Jacquet captures the magic of a fleeting cloud or the dazzle of sunlight streaming through a break in the canopy in exquisite detail, with sweeps across grand vistas and close-ups that travel the length of a single tree shot by remote cameras mounted on small flying drones. The filmmaker sews these scenes together to put the soul of the forest on the big screen. He says walking its hallowed grounds and following its daily rituals tap into what it means to be human.
There is something very ancient
in our brain. I guess this is an idea, but I think we are deeply made to be there.
And if people can forge that bond with nature, Jacquet says, to see themselves as part of the forest and not alien to it, we are a step closer to saving the rainforest rather than becoming an agent in its demise. Once Upon a Forest is being shown worldwide at film festivals, is in commercial release in Europe, and will be seen later this year in Asia and Latin America. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Calais, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Health officials in West Africa are struggling to contain an outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever, a deadly contagion that has claimed more than 100 lives. The first cases were reported last month in Guinea, and now also are being seen in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. While working to respond to the crisis, the World Health Organization has not recommended any trade or travel restrictions in the region. Nevertheless, as a sign of its concern, Senegal has closed the land border it shares with Guinea as a preventive measure. Given the deadly nature of the disease, such concern is justified. Ebola is highly infectious and has no cure. A particularly virulent virus, Ebola is believed to originate in an infected animal and is spread to humans by diet or contact with bodily fluids. Its early symptoms include fever and weakness, then deepens with bouts of diarrhea, vomiting, and internal bleeding. There have been previous outbreaks of the disease in the forests of Central Africa, but this is the first incidence of it reported in the West African nations now contending with it. They are not acting alone, though. The United States and other partners are working with international health officials to aid the fight. A five-member team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Viral Special Pathogens Branch flew to Guinea on March 31st to provide expert advice and consultation. In addition, a small team of CDC experts will travel to Liberia to provide technical assistance to the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. The U.S. Agency for International Development is funding a mobile laboratory in Guinea that can quickly do tests in suspected cases of the disease. Under another USAID grant, protective equipment is being provided to healthcare workers treating the sick. The U.S. Defense Department is working with Metabioba, Inc., a company that monitors viral disease threats around the world, to provide assistance for lab testing of samples from suspect cases. Our diplomatic missions in the capitals of the affected nations, as well as others, are monitoring the situation there closely. And USAID has provided $583,500 through UNICEF's Regional Rapid Response Fund to provide households and clinics in Guinea with supplies and equipment, as well as fund a public information campaign to help people protect themselves from infection. Finally, we extend our sympathies to the families and loved ones of those who have died. And for those fighting the disease, know that our hearts and prayers are with you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.